Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, folks, where we have a discussion on Trump's Middle East strategy, question mark. And our speaker tonight is Michael Doran, who's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C., and among other books, he's the author of Eisenhower and the Middle East. And I should say initially that the visit tonight has been, that Mr. Doran's been brought to Australia by the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council, and we're grateful for their help in putting this on this function tonight. Michael Doran, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for having me, and thanks to AJAC for helping, and thanks to all of you for coming. It's a great pleasure to be here. You may have heard that unlike in Australia, Trump is in the United States is a controversial figure, and he's had a polarizing impact on our politics. In fact, I saw in a Gallup poll just a few days ago that Gallup regards him as the most polarizing president ever. And the effect of that is that everything in the United States now is polarized and politicized. And I think nothing more than Middle East policy. It's also an area of great polarization. We have basically two different views vying for superiority in Washington with regard to the Middle East, two different paradigms. It would be a mistake to see it, the fight between these two paradigms as simply a political battle for and against Trump, although that is definitely part of it. The polarization on the Middle East has been developing for some time now, I think since September 11th. So what I'd like to do before I get to Trump himself and his view is just to describe for you a little bit the two paradigms that are vying, and maybe go back a little bit in time and describe to you the historical events that generated this polarization. For the sake of discussion, I'm going to call the two paradigms the Obama paradigm and the Trump paradigm. I'm saying it's the Obama paradigm because the Obama foreign policy elite is now acting as a kind of shadow government, the shadow foreign ministry, unlike anything I've seen before in the United States. I mean, we usually, when a new president takes over, the old guys melt away. But in this case, they have organized themselves quietly, and they are continuing to have influence. This is the old Obama team. On legislation on Capitol Hill, they're influencing the press. You may have read in the newspaper that John Kerry, the former Secretary of State, went after Trump decided to leave the JCPOA, the Iranian nuclear deal. He went and visited Europe and counseled the Europeans to keep the Iran nuclear deal going, keep it on a kind of low boil or a low burner. He went and he met with Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, and counseled him to stay in the deal and basically to keep the thing alive until 2020, when if Trump is defeated and a Democrat takes over, then the United States can return to the deal. They are working in Washington in a variety of ways, which I'll describe in a few minutes, to preserve the. Not just the nuclear deal itself, but the broader policy architecture that made the deal possible. So even though we now have Donald Trump and his foreign policy, we still have a fight between the Obama team and the Obama perspective on the Middle East and the Trump or Republican perspective. Let me, in order to explain how this all developed, let me go back in time a little bit, back to when Barack Obama was running for president in 2008 and the views that he brought into the White House. They were not his own, the views he had. They were part of a foreign policy elite's critique of George W. Bush. And that critique was encapsulated in something that many of you may recall, the Baker-Hamilton Report. This was the Iraq Study Group of 2006. This was a congressionally mandated report about how to fix what was wrong in Iraq. The war in Iraq was going very badly, and Congress mandated a study of this and demanded that the study come up with recommendations to improve the American position. The study had five major conclusions about what the United States should do. Number one, it should pull troops out of Iraq. Number two, it should increase the troops levels in Afghanistan. Number three, it should reach out to Iran and try to negotiate with the Iranians about Iraq. Number four, it should reach out to Syria and negotiate with the Syrians about Iraq. And number five, it should work hard for advances in the Israeli-Palestinian or in the Israeli-Arab arena, with especially the Israeli-Palestinian arena. That is the blueprint for the Obama foreign policy that Obama brought into the White House. But there was more to it than just that. Obama famously said in an interview with David Remnick, of the editor of The New Yorker, that every president gets in the history books a paragraph. And it's very important when you're president to know what your paragraph is. So President Obama wrote his paragraph on the Middle East actually before he was ever in the Oval Office. And what his paragraph said was, Barack Obama ended the disastrous wars in the Middle East that George W. Bush started, and in particular the Iraq War. We know that he in fact wrote this paragraph before he ever got in the Oval Office, because there's a record of a very interesting conversation that took place in 2008 when he was the presumptive nominee for the Democratic Party. He wasn't even the nominee yet. And he went on a trip to Iraq and he met with David Petraeus, the commander in Iraq, and he told Petraeus in no uncertain terms that if he became president, he was going to pull the troops out of Iraq. And Petraeus said that would be a mistake because the Iranians would then fill the vacuum. Obama said basically, and I paraphrase here, ho-hum. When he got into government, that is what he wanted to do, was to pull the troops out, and he very quickly made a decision by 2010 to pull the troops out. And he was comfortable with the Iranians filling the vacuum because he, in keeping with the authors of the Baker-Hamilton Report, had a very specific understanding of Iran, not one that they like to advertised because it's politically untenable in American in America, but it's common among the foreign policy elite, and I suspect that even some of you share it. But I don't know that because I don't know you, but I can see it in your faces. The view is that Iran is a defensive power. It's a defensive power. It's weak. It's worried about simply keeping power. It's defensive. It's basically a status quo power. It is also pragmatic. It shares very significant interests with the United States. For example, stabilizing Iraq. Why would Iran want a destabilized country right on its border? The United States has no four-star vital interest in Iraq, really. It just wants stability, wants the oil to flow steadily at reasonable prices. That's about all it wants from Iraq. Make sure it's not a basis for terrorism. So the United States could come to a deal with Iran on this. And if Iran wants to stabilize Iraq in a way that is a little bit more advantageous to Iranian interests, the United States can live with that. That was Obama's attitude. Iran shares with the United States an interest in defeating Sunni radicalism. And this is a very, so ISIS and Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda and then later ISIS. This is very important because since 9/11, many in the country, I think politically in the country, but certainly also in the foreign policy elite, came to see the defeat of Sunni radical organizations as the number one priority of the United States in the Middle East, as the overriding priority. In the absence of a clearer understanding of what U.S. strategy should be, counterterrorism kind of trumped everything else. And if we could put together a coalition that included the Iranians and the Russians, or at least found an accommodation with the Iranians and the Russians to defeat the Sunni radical organizations, well, that was okay. One of the problems with George W. Bush's foreign policy, as Obama and his cohort saw it, was that Bush was emphasizing the democratization of the Middle East, and he kind of drew a bright red line and said, you're either with us or against us in democratizing and in fighting terrorism. And he put on the side of powers that were against us the Iranians and the Syrians. And then his push for democracy also pushed the Russians to the other side of the red line. And Obama's saying, no. We don't have to be so categorical about all of this. These are nasty actors, for sure, but we do share interests with them. And if we define our interests more narrowly, as in defeating Sunni terrorism and stabilizing the region, well, then we can find common ground to work with the Russians and the Iranians and the Syrians and so forth. And that's then the essence of the... that's the essence of those recommendations in the Baker-Hamilton report. We're to pull the troops out of Iraq because Iraq was a mistaken war to begin with. We're to reach out to the Iranians and the Syrians because while they're nasty actors, they can help us stabilize. Iraq. We're going to plus up the troops in Afghanistan because the real war, the serious war, is against Al-Qaeda and Sunni radicalism, not against Saddam Hussein or anybody else. And about the Arab-Israeli conflict, the fifth item in there, I'll get to that later. so that's the worldview. Now, if you believe all that, and your goal, which was the goal of Barack Obama, is to pull the United States out of the Middle East and not to get involved in unwinnable or difficult wars in the region, you still have one big problem. Or let's just say, if your goal is to pull the United States back and in so doing come to an accommodation with the Iranians about stabilizing the region, you still have a big problem. And that problem is the Iranian nuclear program. Because the American people believe, all of America's key allies in the region believe that the Iranian nuclear program is an existential threat. And the American people are very concerned about the nuclear program. So if you just pick up and leave and then start working with the Iranians and you don't do anything about the nuclear program, it won't work. And you can't actually have a functioning partnership or accommodation with the Iranians unless you do something about the nuclear program. So that the nuclear negotiations then become the centerpiece of the Obama strategy in the Middle East. Obama very cleverly sold the nuclear deal to the American people as an arms control agreement only, a narrow arms control agreement. And when people like me said, you're actually trying to create a concert system in the Middle East in which you can work with the Iranians to stabilize the region, the Obama administration would say, are you crazy? We're not trying to do that. We're simply doing an arms control agreement. And that's it. But they were, in fact, trying to stabilize the region with Iran. And they wanted to take the nuclear program and park it off to one side so it wouldn't create friction. And not just wouldn't create friction, perhaps it would create a basis, a kind of new model for how to deal with the Iranians. It would show them that we were not, we didn't regard relations with them as a zero-sum game. We didn't regard them as an enemy. We saw the possibility of reaching mutually beneficial arrangements based on a commonality of interest. That would then kind of start a big snowball, wrong image in the Middle East, a big sandstorm of a big sandstorm of goodwill, which would grow in Tehran and create opportunities for more for more agreement with the Iranians. And you can see very clearly in their actions that they believe this. They had denied it when accused of this. They denied it. But the Europeans said very clearly that that was the goal over and over again. If you listen to the, for instance, the Germans who marched in lockstep with the with President Obama on this, they were saying all along that that was the goal. And you can see by the actions of the Obama administration because that was the goal, because they did, the Obama administration did two things that were very notable while they were negotiating the JCPOA, the nuclear deal. One is, they turned a blind eye to the Iranian and Russian intervention in Syria and all of the killing that that entailed. I mean, by today, we now have 1 million killed in Syria and 12 million displaced. Most of those are at the hands of the Iranian-Russian-Syrian coalition. And the Obama administration did nothing to try to prevent that. It did nothing because if it did anything, it would have alienated the Iranians and the Russians, and that would have made the JCPOA impossible, which would have made the withdrawal from Iraq impossible, which would have ruined the paragraph that he wrote before he got into presidency. So that's one thing. The other thing is that the moment the Obama administration signed the JCPOA, or it was never signed but completed the JCPOA, the president and his team brought the Iranians into the formal negotiations about what to do about Syria. So clearly they had the idea of using them as partners for stabilizing Syria in the end. Okay, so now for the Republican perspective or the Trump perspective, the Republicans looked at this in horror. And they were, first of all, horrified by the JCPOA itself. They felt that the Obama administration showed the Iranians that it was desperate to get a deal and took the terms that the Iranians offered, which were lousy terms. And without going, you probably read a lot about it, and without going into great detail about it, I'll just say there were three major problems. There are more, but there are three that are worth talking about here with the JCPOA from the Republican point of view. One is the restrictions that it places on the Iranian nuclear program are very temporary. They last little more than a decade. Some of them last longer than a decade, but the really meaningful ones last for only a decade, which is not a long time in the life of a nuclear program. And so it did nothing. It did nothing to convince the Saudis, for example, or the Israelis that Iran was not had actually foregone had dispensed with its desire to get a nuclear weapon. The second thing it did is it lifted the restrictions in international law on Iran's ballistic missile program. The Iranians at the last stage of the negotiation, recognizing that the Obama administration was desperate to get a deal, the Iranians demanded that the prohibition in the United Nations on their ballistic missiles program would be lessened. And it would go from being a command for them not to have a program to being an exhortation that they not have a program. And the third thing, that's significant, not just because ballistic missiles are used really only for launching nuclear weapons, but the missile program in general of the Iranians is being used to fuel their proxies or to arm their proxies around the region. Which brings me to the next point of what was wrong with the JCPOA. It turned a blind eye to everything that Iran was doing on the ground, which was building up militias all across the region, in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, on the model of the Hezbollah militia, which it built up in Lebanon. And in fact, it's using Hezbollah to spread its military doctrine and its methods, its media manipulation, and so on to these proxies on the ground. The Obama administration turned a blind eye to them. In fact, as I said, the idea was to become, to turn Iran into a partner for stability, and so we tolerated all of these, the proliferation of these militias. And the Iranians were very eager to show the world that the restrictions that they accepted on the temporary and rather minuscule restrictions on their nuclear program that they accepted were not a sign that they were going to make concessions anywhere else in the region. So while this was deal was being negotiated, they, for example, began a very serious intervention in Yemen with the results that we see today when you look at Yemen. So when President Trump came in, he wanted to reverse all of this. Wanted to counter the Iranians on the ground, and wanted to counter the wanted to fill the gaps in the nuclear program, in the nuclear deal, or wanted to rectify its deficiencies. But President Trump shares with President Obama one common goal. There's a line of very significant continuity from Trump from Obama to Trump. And that's basically the paragraph that Obama wanted to write. Trump has a similar paragraph. He wants to go down in history as a president who kept the Middle East at bay. Like Obama, he doesn't want another major U.S. military intervention in the region. So unlike Obama, he's committed to containing Iran and to putting pressure on it and to reversing some of the concessions that Obama made to Iran. But he doesn't want to do it directly with U.S. military power. So what's left then? How are you going to do it? Well, allies, traditional allies. And so what you found from the moment Donald Trump took over, the first thing he did when he got into the Oval Office is he went on a trip to Saudi Arabia and to Israel. And he also started at the same time an effort to come to improve relations with Turkey, with Erdogan and Turkey. That's the most difficult aspect here. Because these three powers, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, they are the most significant allies that the United States has in the region. And they are really the only ones capable of projecting power beyond their borders. It's a very hard thing to do to put these three powers. If you know the Middle East, you know they don't get along well. None of them really get along that well with each other, and they have mismatched capabilities. But two of them, the Israelis and the Saudis, regard the rise of Iran as an existential threat. So there is the possibility of cooperating with those two for sure against Iran. The Turks have a more complex relationship with Iran, and it's not as hostile as the Saudis and the Israelis' relationship is. But if you can bring the Turks on side, and arrest the drift of Turkey away from the West, then you can sort of turn it into at least an area where it and its sphere of interest as an area where the Iranians are not operating. I mean, the Turks are not attractive as opponents of Iran, but you can say that wherever Turkey is, Iran is not, and that's a good thing. If a goal of your policy is to push back against the Iranians and more broadly the Russian-Iranian alliance. That's basically where we are. There's two different visions that are fighting out in Washington today. The Obama vision, it looks at the Middle East as a round table, and the United States is sort of the chairman of the board. When in the Obama White House, they stopped using the words allies and enemies when talking about Middle Eastern states. And instead, they talked about problem sets and stakeholders. So there's a Syria problem set, and then you have to say, well, who are the stakeholders in Syria? And Iran and Russia are stakeholders. And so the job of the United States is to get everybody around the round table and to come up with solutions that we might all find mutually advantageous, and then we can keep the worst pathologies of the region at bay. Trump's view is that the Middle East is a rectangular table, and on one side are America's traditional allies, Turkey, Israel, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Jordan, and so on. And on the other side are the Iranians, Russians, Hezbollah, all the other militias of the Iranians and whatnot. And the goal of the United States in that vision is to elevate the allies of the United States over the Iranian alliance system on the other side, and to mediate between the allies on the American side, because they don't get along with each other very well. And that's a difficult thing to do. Now, how much longer, Gerard, do I have?
Two hours?
What about 10 minutes?
10 minutes? Great. Okay, so in the 10 minutes that I've got left, I want to expand them to about 20 or 30 minutes. And then I want to talk a little bit about their holes in the Trump strategy. And then I want to talk a little bit about what I said I was going to tell you about the Arab-Israeli conflict and the difference in the two paradigms with regard to the Arab-Israeli conflict. And then I'll stop. There are some holes in the Trump strategy, some obvious deficiencies. The biggest deficiency is that the United States is not really countering Iran on the ground effectively. Because, as I mentioned, there's this continuity between Obama to Trump, and Trump doesn't want to deploy American military. So it's down to the allies to do it. And what that means is that the Israelis are the ones countering the Iranians in Syria, and they're very active in Syria attacking Iranian positions. The Obama administration was unhappy with Israeli actions against Iran in Syria and did everything it could to make it difficult and unpleasant for the Israelis to take those actions without getting into a public fight with them. The Trump administration is supportive, and that makes a difference because it has a deterrent effect on the Russians. But the Israelis then are still bearing the brunt of the load and the significant risk, because as they take action against the Iranians in Syria, they are they come into friction with the Russians, because the Russians and the Iranians are in an alliance in Syria, a military alliance, and there's a division of labor between them whereby the Iranians provide the troops on the ground and the Russians provide the air cover. So when the Israelis go in from the air and strike the Iranians, it's embarrassing deeply to Putin, and that creates a difficult relationship, and the Israelis are quite happy to have the United States behind them so that Putin Putin sees not just Israeli military power, but also America in the background. Of course, the Israelis would be a lot happier if the United States was actually acting on the ground in Syria too against Iran, but it's not going to do that. The Saudis are also acting against the Iranians on the ground in Yemen, but the Americans have, in general, have a much more ambivalent attitude about the Saudi war in Yemen, and are not as supportive of the Saudis against the Houthis in Yemen as they are of the Israelis in Syria, and that's a problem because if the Houthis are not, if the Iranians are not driven from Yemen, we're going to have a Hezbollah-like organization in Yemen that can strike Riyadh with missiles and rockets, just as Hezbollah could strike Israel with missiles and rockets, but that can also threaten Red Sea shipping. As we've already seen, if you've been following it, the Houthis have fired at American ships and at the ships of Saudis and others in the Red Sea. That isn't actually the Houthis doing it. I mean, the Houthis are pushing the button when the rockets are fired. But they are doing so under the direct tutelage of the Iranians. And we have decided so far not to say that, because if we say it, then the question immediately arises, well, what are you going to do about it? And we're not sure we want to do anything about it, so we pretend that that's not exactly what's going on, but that is what's going on. There's also a problem in Iraq. The continuity between Obama to Trump was not simply on the fact that Trump, like Obama, wanted to keep the Middle East at arm's length. Trump also accepted, when he came into power, the Obama strategy for defeating ISIS in Iraq and Syria. That strategy was predicated on the notion that Iran can be our, if not our ally or our partner, at least a power with common interests with regard to ISIS. And so we turned a blind eye to the rise of the popular mobilization units in Iraq, which are Iranian armed, trained, and equipped, and basically guided from Iran. And those units played an important role in defeating ISIS in Mosul. So we worked from the air, and the Iranian armed, trained, and equipped forces worked from the ground. And we became the air force of the Iranians, but again, we didn't admit that that was actually going on, because if we admitted that, it would be, it would run counter to what we believe about ourselves. So we didn't allow ourselves to even think that we were doing what we were doing, and that situation hasn't completely ended, the contradiction there. So as the Israelis have been striking the Iranians in Syria, the Iranians are now moving capability, rockets and missiles and whatnot, to Iraq, where they could strike Israel from there. But the Israelis can't strike, the Israelis cannot strike the Iranians in Iraq, because the Americans are there. American forces are still there, and that would bring Israel into, that would cause America all kinds of problems with its Iraqi allies, who are also allied with the Iranians. And so you still have this distortion, although Trump has gone far to sort of move the strategy back to one where we have allies working against enemies. There are still pockets where we are a little too close to the people that we have defined as too close for comfort to people that we have defined as enemies. Where we are doing quite well with that strategy, though, with the Trump strategy, is in the reimposition of economic sanctions on the Iranians after leaving the JCPOA. We have reduced the exports, Iranian oil exports, significantly, and there's, by all indications, they are hurting financially as a result of this. But there's no sign that they're going to be toppled or going to cry uncle between now and 2020. So I expect for the next, I don't know, how long is it until the election? 17 months, 16 months? I don't know. However long it is between now and November 2020, this situation won't change drastically. The contradictions will remain contradictions. The pressure that we're putting on the Iranians militarily and economically will remain. And we won't see a drastic change until the presidential election, when the administration might decide to plug some of the holes in the strategy, or when a new administration will take over, and then we go back to Obama land. Now, on that note, a couple of statements about the Arab-Israeli conflict, and then I'll open it up for questions. The two paradigms, as I think I've suggested here, the two different paradigms. The key issue on which the two different paradigms clash is Iran. That's the central issue. But they also have a very different understanding of the Arab-Israeli conflict and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I think I'm already out of time, so I'll just summarize very, very quickly. The Democratic view, the Obama view, is that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a strategically significant conflict, and that the major impediment for improving relations between the Israelis and the Palestinians is the Israelis, and in particular the Israeli settlements. And so the Democrats, and particularly the progressive Democrats, focus a great amount of attention on Israeli settlements and on depicting the Netanyahu government in Israel as an unacceptable partner for the United States. Now, they may actually believe that, but they also see it as a way of denigrating, of delegitimating one of the most influential actors in convincing the United States to adopt the Trump view of Iran as a threat. What I'm trying to say is that Benjamin Netanyahu is extremely influential in America. Americans listen to him. Both America, the American elite, and the public listen to him. He has a unique influence in America, and his view of the Middle East runs directly counter to the Obama view. So it's not just about settlements, it's also about Iran. But so if you can depict him as a as an unacceptable partner for the United States, then you have gone far to delegitimate the Trump view of Iran as a threat. The similar thing is going on, by the way, with respect to Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. Now, you may have been aware that Mohammed bin Salman has done a few unpleasant things. Which is, there's no doubt about that. But there's also a campaign afoot in Washington to not let you forget that he has done a few unpleasant things and to present those unpleasant things as proof that he is an unacceptable partner to the United States in stabilizing the Middle East. And the reason for that is that he and Netanyahu together are saying to the world and to the Americans that Iran is the problem. So the people, the former Obama officials who do not think Iran is the problem want to delegitimate both of them. The Republican view of the Arab-Israeli conflict is that, and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is that it is not strategically significant or as strategically significant as the Democrats think it is. If we got an agreement tomorrow between Mahmoud Abbas and Netanyahu, it would not significantly change the position of the United States in the Middle East at all. The basic balance of power in the region and the challenges that we face would be pretty much the same tomorrow as they would as they were yesterday, even after an agreement. It really would only have significance for Israel, the Palestinians, Jordan, and Egypt. And with respect to Jordan and Egypt, not even that much influence at all. So it's actually a rather minor. It's actually a rather minor regional problem in the eastern Mediterranean. It has a huge valence around it for all kinds of reasons. So it has a kind of political valence around it that is out of all proportion to its actual strategic significance. Now, there's no way that we can ever bridge these two visions of the Middle East. You have to just make a decision. Is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict a big deal or not? Is Iran a defensive power, or is it an aggressive and hegemonic power? We can argue until we're blue in the face about this, but I've been doing this for a long time, and I usually find that people that think that Iran is defensive cannot be convinced that it's aggressive, and people who think it's aggressive cannot be convinced that it's defensive. And so we just have to battle this out at the ballot box. Thank you.
Many thanks to Michael Doran for a stimulating and informative discussion. Once again, thanks to the Australia-Israel...
Let me take my secret notes away here.
Thanks to the Australian-Israel and Jewish Affairs Council for making this speech possible tonight. So we come to the questions and discussion. There are a lot of people here, so you've got to be quick with your question or your comment like this. What you depicted at the start was a kind of counter-administration, which, of course, is most unusual in United States politics. The former leftist and now conservative David Horowitz commented some time ago that this was the first occasion since the Civil War in 1860 where the other party didn't accept the election of the president. Now, he wasn't saying it was going to be a civil war, but it is an unusual situation, isn't it, where there is just so much opposition to accepting an elected American president. I mean, someone who works in think tanks, how do you see all that?
Thank you. I've never seen anything like it. I'm not an expert on American domestic politics, but it's not like anything that I've seen since I became aware of politics. And when I talk to people who are older than me, it's not like anything that they've ever seen. One of the things that is really striking about it, I think, is the rise of what my colleague at the Hudson Institute, Walter Russell Mead, calls Jacksonian America. Jacksonian America is basically, you could say, the white working class, although you don't necessarily have to be white to be Jacksonian. But Jacksonians are the Scotch-Irish, the Scotch-Irish working class and rural types. Who have the same kind of attitudes about politics that Andrew Jackson had. And those attitudes are basically, if you leave me alone, I'll leave you alone. But if you represent an existential threat or a significant threat to the United States, we'll destroy you with great ruthlessness. And so you get this kind of duality with the Jacksonians in that if they perceive an existential threat like Nazi Germany, the Soviet Union, then they are great interventionists abroad. But if they don't perceive an existential threat, well, then they're very inward-looking and almost isolationist. And that's how you can get, when America comes under attack or under a threat, you suddenly get this great expansion of power outward and then followed by these retractions. We haven't seen this. You can see it in the past. At World War I is a great example, where the United States exploded outward and then retracted. We haven't seen that in a long time because of the Cold War. What's happened now, though, is that those same Jacksonians who have this attitude toward foreign policy have an extremely jaundiced view of the elite in America today. And that is what Donald Trump tapped into. But it's not only Trump. There is a populism on the left, which is also denigrating the elite. Everything that Donald Trump has said about foreign policy during the campaign was not really or not simply foreign policy. It was also a way of saying that the elite that's been ruling over you has been engaging in international its internationalist policies are designed to enrich it at your expense. It's a very effective message. If I could just make one more note about this, Jacksonian America loves Israel. America is a Zionist country in general. And if you think about some of the moves that Trump has made recently, recognizing the embassy in Jerusalem, recognizing Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, this is fantastic domestic politics for Donald Trump. These are very popular actions, and not simply among Jacksonians, but the Jacksonians are his base, and they love it. They love it because they like Israel, but they also love it because the elite hates it. Right? These actions are tailor-made for Donald Trump because they make liberal heads explode. And if you're a Jacksonian in Anadarko, Oklahoma, you can hear those explosions in New York and L.A. and so on, and it just warms your heart.
Now, if you want to ask a question, you've got to get your hand up, otherwise you can't be seen. You've got to get it right up, Ida, otherwise it can't be seen. You've got to be brief.
Thanks for your presentation, Michael. We Australians are increasingly worried about China's power in our region. You didn't mention China at all. Could you comment, please?
Well, I think the talk was on the Middle East.
I've been studying the Middle East long enough that I can associate anything with the Middle East. Two points on that. One is that with regard to this Jacksonian America has yet to see China as the kind of existential threat that, say, Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union was. If that happens, then I think you in Australia will see the America that you got to know over the last 50 years come back. If it doesn't happen, then you're going to have this kind of uncertain America that I think is worrying a lot of people here. In the Middle East, we're seeing the greater encroachment by China than ever before. But it's still a secondary area for China. But it's interesting; they are doing things in China, in the Middle East now that we thought they were not going to do. They're getting involved in security issues. They, for instance, control the commercial and the commercial military drone market, and they're selling American allies drones. They are on the ground in Syria, not in large numbers, but they're on the ground, and they have asserted an interest in the outcome of the Syrian civil war. On the side of the Iranians and the Russians, for example. They've built a base in Djibouti. So they're laying down capability that would allow them in a second to become a significant actor, and we have to be worried about that. I don't think we've really woken up to that yet.
Question here. Stay here.
Thank you very much. Push it up. Push it up, Pops. Thank you.
Okay.
Push it up.
Hello. Hi.
thank you so much. Can you please comment on President Trump's negotiating style, his negotiating techniques, which a lot of people see as mercurial?
There's a question about Donald Trump's negotiating techniques?
So his negotiating techniques, Donald Trump is, you said mercurial, that's a good word. I think he's sometimes impulsive, sometimes extremely touchy. He goes off on in fights that have no which that look counterproductive, and one can't ever discern any rational reason for going into these fights. And then he is sometimes very strategic and extremely perceptive. I mean, he actually explained during the campaign how he was going to win the election and how he was going to put together an electoral coalition that was different than anything the Republicans had done before. He went and did exactly that, and everyone said he couldn't. So sometimes he has great insight. Sometimes he's a very clever negotiator, and sometimes he's just mercurial and touchy. I think what we have is somebody who does have some of the flaws that his critics accuse him of having, but he has found ways to turn those flaws into assets in certain situations, and so it makes him it's what makes him so difficult to read. It makes him difficult to read. He likes being difficult to read, and sometimes it can be an asset. Other times it can be confounding, even to his friends.
Question here.
Thanks very much. How do you see the Kurds fitting into all this?
You know, I avoided that whole thing. That's it. Yeah. Let me see if I can make a really short answer, because it's a huge question, and it's actually one of the most important strategic questions in the region right now, because when you say the Kurds, I assume you're referring to the YPG, the Syrian Kurdish organization that we allied with to defeat ISIS. The problem from Trump's point of view is that we were totally alienating Turkey through that policy, because the YPG is the Syrian extension of the PKK, the Kurdish separatist movement in Turkey. By 2043, one-third of all Turks, are Turkish citizens, are going to be Kurds. So we were building up a separatist state on the border that was going to give a Kurdish autonomous statelet on the Turkish border that was going to give the PKK strategic depth. 80% of Turks now regard the United States as an enemy power. That is significantly greater than the percentage of Turks who support President Erdogan. So we have created a problem with Turkey, and President Trump is trying to alleviate that by tilting back toward the Turks. Now, the challenge you have here, and I'll just summarize it like this, and we'll be done with it, but it's a huge issue, is that if we go all the way toward Turkey, and then work against the YPG, the YPG will go to the Russians and the Iranians. And then the Russians and the Iranians will use the YPG to put pressure on the Turks. If we continue doing what we were doing with the YPG, from Trump's point of view, that had two problems. Number one, as he said to General Mattis time and time again, you are laying the groundwork for another Afghanistan. We've been in Afghanistan 17 years. We don't know who we're fighting. We don't know what we're fighting about. We don't know what victory looks like, and we don't know how we're going to achieve it. And you keep telling me I can't get out of there. Now we're going to have another one of these where we're going to start a Turkish-Kurdish war, and we're going to be on the side of the Kurds with no way to ever get out. So I don't want to be in that situation. But also, it was driving Turkey into the arms of the Russians and the Iranians. So the ideal situation, the Goldilocks solution, is for the United States to own the negotiations between the Turks and the YPG, much as the United States owns the negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Now, everyone knows it tilts more toward the Israelis than the Palestinians, but still, it owns those negotiations. What Trump would like is to tilt more toward Turkey than the YPG, but to own the negotiation. But the Russians are intent on insinuating themselves into that relationship, and the Turks are going to the Russians to put pressure on us, and the YPG is going to the Russians to put pressure on us. So it's a very difficult situation. But at stake here is the geostrategic orientation of Turkey, which is probably the most important thing in play in the Middle East today.
Michael, thank you for telling us that we really have to worry about the complexities of the South China Sea. The surge under Petraeus, that you would be very familiar with, stabilised the internal problems in Iraq, essentially, and looked like, to me at least, and I've been to Kurdistan three times in the last 10 years, that there would be a continuing US presence that would have diplomatic ballast in the same way as the US presence in South Korea and in Okinawa. Pulling out, remove that ballast, and the ship turned over. Given that Trump does win the 2020 election, would he look at that kind of permanent ballast being reinserted there to provide stability in all sorts of areas?
That's a great question. My guess is no. In that, if I understood you correctly, the reestablishing the ballast would mean introducing American troops and back into Iraq to protect the Sunni areas. I think that that's not going to. I doubt that that's going to happen. It's possible, though. I mean, what you would have to have a total change in American mindset about Iraq. That dilemma I mentioned with respect to the Israelis not being able to strike the Iranians because we are there. We are committed, and everyone who works on Iraq is committed to a one Iraq policy and to building up state institutions. What's happened is we build up state institutions and the Iranians move in and hollow them out. And so that our aid then actually works to the advantage of the Iranians. And we tell ourselves stories like, there are natural antibodies in Iraqi Arab society to Iranian influence, even among Iraqi Shiites. And if we just keep at this long enough, sooner or later, those natural antibodies will take over and get rid of the Iranians. I don't see that happening. But I don't see the Americans at this stage, I can't see that they have decided to abandon the policy of building up state institutions and promoting one Iraq. The logic of what I was saying, if we're going to have an actual counter-Iran strategy consistent across the board, then what we would have to do is start moving into Iraq and picking up assets like as we did in the past with the tribes in Al-Anbar. We could also reposition our troops to the KRG, and we could start working directly to build up the KRG, or at least up the Barzani, the Talibani leans toward Iran. But we could build up Barzani, but that's then an abandonment of the one Iraq policy, in effect, or at least lessening our commitment to it, and that's a real paradigm shift for the Americans. And I don't see any sign that they're moving in that direction. There are some of our allies who will remain nameless who are suggesting that we do it. So it's not impossible.
Michael Foscio.
Thank you, Michael, and thanks for a very interesting speech. You talk a lot about Obama's approach and Trump's approach. The presidents generally, I would think, also have a lot of advisors. They have the Pentagon, they have the State Department. And, you know, decisions that Obama made or Clinton made or Bush made have been influenced by those groups. Could you comment on Trump's approach, given that he's had quite a checkered history, if you like, with dealing with secretaries of state, defense secretaries, and so on, and, you know, those substantial organs of government who are there advising and looking at the long term, okay, not just, you know, what happens today or tomorrow. And added to that, George Bush said, of course, that one of the axes of evil was North Korea. And I think it's reasonable, at least, for people to say, well, hang on, Obama did the deal with Iran, sought to do a deal with Iran, and whatever criticisms one can have about that agreement, and I have some, what we've got here is a president who's actually, you know, now cuddling up to the leader of North Korea, trying to do a deal with a nuclear-powered state. So.
Just before you do, we'll make this the final question, final comment.
One of the themes of the Trump administration one of the characteristics of it has been that the president has been slow to fill a lot of key positions in the administration. Part of the reason for that is that the Republican foreign policy establishment doesn't like his view of the world. Many of my colleagues who served with me in the Bush administration signed these Never Trump letters, which said that he's going to be the worst president in human history, or the worst leader in human history, and is going to bring disaster to the Republic, and so on and so forth. So he didn't have a cohort to pull from. As time has gone on, he has developed a cohort that sees the world, if not exactly like him, more like him. You know, John Bolton is the National Security Advisor. Mike Pompeo is Secretary of State. They work very well with him. He has a number of senators that he talks to regularly and that are also helping him to turn his inclinations into coherent and sustainable policy. People like Tom Cotton of Arkansas and Ted Cruz and so on. So I think we're seeing, as time goes on, I think we're seeing a much more coherent picture. Where he did have a lot of friction was with General Mattis. A lot of it behind the scenes. Mattis, surprisingly, surprised me, basically had an Obama view of the Middle East. Now, when I said it was an Obama view, that was just for shorthand. It's the foreign policy elite that did not, that segment of the foreign policy elite, which was a significant part of the career bureaucracy in the State Department and the CIA and so on, they had the identical view of Obama, or a very similar one. Now, Obama probably went further than they were comfortable with on certain things. Some of the concessions to the Iranians went beyond, I think, the comfort zone of some of those people. And the failure to do anything in Syria against the Russians and the Iranians. I don't know if you remember, there was actually a little minor rebellion in the State Department. I wouldn't say minor, but a quiet rebellion against the policy in the State Department, which was very unusual. Especially because the State Department is full of Democrats, and Obama was very popular among the Democrats. Of course, they all are—they're not actually registered as Democrats, but their worldview is Democratic. With respect to the nuclear question and North Korea, I don't really see them as analogous because. The issue is not negotiating with the Iranians or negotiating with the North Koreans. The issue is the concessions that were made. And Trump has been very clear that he would be willing to sit down with the Iranians like he sat down with the North Koreans and negotiate with them. And he's been very clear about what he thinks is wrong with the deal. The fact that the restrictions are temporary, the ballistic missiles, the fact that it turned a blind eye to the and actually ended up advancing the Iranian muscle movements elsewhere in the region, as well as the question of inspections. So if the Iranians were interested in cutting a deal, they could they could sit down with Donald Trump just like the North Koreans are. Thank you.
Many thanks. We had enough questions and comments to go on for another hour, but we can't. So I'd just like to say to Michael Doran tonight, thanks for a stimulating talk, and I think all of us here tonight learned something and got a lot to think about, covering so much ground in about 40 minutes of a talk and 20 minutes of question discussion. It was quite an achievement. I think you've just arrived in Sydney tonight. You've got other appointments in Australia, and I'll keep you busy with the organisation with whom you're visiting. But for tonight, great talk. Well done.
Thank you. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.